night. This is Mel Gaynor, and you're listening to the Global Drum Network. Keep on playing, keep it real, keep the faith.
Drum Network, bringing drummers together from all around the world. Yes, hello, I'm Bob Spry. Welcome to episode 10 of the Global Drum Network podcast. It's an important milestone for us, and we'd like to thank everyone who has contributed to the show's success, from our fantastic guests to you, our wonderful listeners. Thank you all. If you like what you hear and would like to support our work by making a donation, please have a look at the video we've posted on our website. For as little as a dollar per episode, you can enjoy some exclusive rewards which literally can't be bought elsewhere, and you'll find all the details on the video. This time we bring you another bumper edition featuring our exclusive interviews with the mighty Mel Gaynor of Simple Minds and Tim Broughton from Provenance Drums, who builds custom snares with a unique historical twist. First up, then, is Mel Gaynor, a man who needs little introduction as his work with Simple Minds has straddled the whole world over three decades. But did you know that his CV also includes such luminaries as Tina Turner, The Pretenders, Robert Palmer, Imagination and The Nolans? Listen up and much will be revealed. By the way, sincere apologies for the poor sound quality on this piece. Some bolshy security staff made it impossible to find any quiet space inside the venue, but Mel graciously suggested we recorded our chat in the multi-story car park as the audience began to arrive. Rock and roll, eh? Here we are again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Today is a beautiful sunny day. It's a Sunday and we're down in Boscombe. And to be precise, we're at the O2 Academy in Boscombe, Bournemouth, which my research tells me is a turn-of-the-century, good old-fashioned music hall. It was originally the Boscombe Grand Theatre, then the Hippodrome. In the 60s, it became Starker's Royal Parade Ballroom, would you believe? And it's played host to the likes of George Formby, Max Miller, T-Rex, Hawkwind, and tonight, 80s stadium rockers Simple Minds. And it's my very great pleasure to introduce to you the mighty Mel Gaynor.
Hello there.
Hello, Mel.
How you doing?
I'm having a great day, and welcome to the Global Drum Network.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So it's not a greatest hits tour you're on.
No, it's actually to promote our new album called Big Music, which has been out since October, and we're on the nationwide and European tour to promote it.
Yep, how's that going?
It's going very well, yeah. So far we've pretty much sold out the whole of the tour, and we've been out since January, so it's a long time we've been out, but it's all been very good. We're on the UK stretch now, which finishes in the 5th of May, actually.
Uh-huh. Oh, coming up close to the end of the run.
Yeah.
And it's been a hectic old schedule, you were saying?
Yeah, it's been, three on, sometimes four on shows, one day off.
Yeah.
So it's not a lot of time to scratch your head, but it's going well and it's flying well.
Yeah, that's great.
We've had no major hiccups.
He says, touching wood. And no doubt, with
The band's been celebrating 35 years, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There's an awful lot of hits that the audiences are lapping up, as well as this new material.
Absolutely.
And what's it like when you get together in pre-production for a tour like this? Do you rework those classics with some new arrangements, or?
Yeah, I mean, we try to incorporate as many of the old tunes as possible, as many of the classics as possible. I don't think we aim to play the whole of the new album, because it's never the case anyway. So we usually cherry pick a lot of the songs to play, and then after that, we thrash them out in the rehearsals,
yeah,
and then include all the classics within that set.
Yeah, excellent. So let me take you back now, because you've been with Simple Minds for 32 years, by
That's
my
correct.
Reckoning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you joined them as an already established session player.
Yeah,
you'd been very successful with a load of very high profile artists.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You were responsible for the drum part on Simply the Best, amongst
That's
others.
Right.
So how did the call for Simple Minds come about?
Well, the call for Simple Minds came about when I was actually in a studio called Utopia, which is not existing anymore, and I was playing on a Heatwave album.
All right, yeah.
With a producer called Peter Walsh.
Yeah.
And it came about that the band needed a drummer. Which they already had a drummer, but he wasn't cutting it.
Right.
And this was in the Townhouse studio, so I had to get from one studio to the other. And they said, basically, the producer asked me to if I would like to play on the Simple Minds album. And I, at the time, didn't know who Simple Minds were. I had no clue. So I said, yeah, sure, I'll come and, you know, play a session. A session is a session.
Yes.
Yeah. And I ended up playing on the album. And then, obviously, joining the band after.
Yes.
So the old drummer was ousted and I came in.
Okay.
And that's pretty much the norm for a lot of the sessions that I was doing at that time, was covering for other drummers.
Yes.
And that's pretty much how I got on the session scene.
Okay. Yeah, there's quite a few very well-known drummers who are brought in to maybe patch up, make do and mend where perhaps a name drummer has not quite come up with the goods on a track for a band.
Absolutely.
I think I read somewhere Bernard Purdy was saying he'd patched up something for Ringo.
Yeah, I think that's hearsay.
That,
I think that's hearsay.
I do too.
You know, I think Ringo played a lot of his sessions. The only drummer I know that, or the only two drummers that I know that played with the Beatles on their sessions was Alan White.
Oh yeah,
and Paul McCartney.
Right.
So that's the only two drummers I know. I think Bernard Purdy was chancing it a bit. So
being a bit cheeky.
I think so.
So, I think I read somewhere that, and I don't want to be dissing anybody here, but the thing that was making the band and maybe the production people look elsewhere for a drummer to work on that album for Simple Minds was an issue with them getting to grips with the click.
I wasn't actually sure what the criteria was on that album, to be quite honest. To this
okay.
day I don't know.
Right.
But I believe it was a dysfunction, let's say,
yeah,
within the player.
Okay.
I don't think he was playing particularly well or playing to the style that they wanted.
Oh, okay.
So I think I came in and nailed it pretty much, because I knew they wanted a more or less, not disco, but more or less a solid funk backbeat to the songs they were playing.
Yeah.
And he wasn't really providing that.
Okay, yeah.
So
yeah,
that's where I came in and just nailed it, really.
Yeah, yeah. And since then you've had, maybe not necessarily yourself built this reputation, but a reputation has been built around you, let's say, for being a really big hitter with a huge sound. But I know there's actually a lot more to you and your playing than that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the reason for the big hitting actually stemmed from being in rock bands or being in rock bands just before, prior to Simple Minds.
Mm-hmm.
But I started out as a jazz player.
Yeah.
I started out as a jazz player, a rock, and a funk player.
Yes.
So I wasn't really hard hitting in the beginning at all. It wasn't until I joined a heavy metal band called Samson.
All right, yeah.
That I actually got to start to hit hard because I had to.
Yes.
And you know,
spinning guitars and all.
Well, spinning guitars, you know, and multiple, let's say, Marshall stacks. You know, I had to put me in that position. So
yeah, so you got to hit big to hit hard, cut through.
I actually remember something that Cozy Powell said. He said he started off, believe it or not, as a jazz player.
Yeah, he did. And, yeah, he got his name from Cozy Cole, didn't he?
That's right. Yeah, and he wasn't that hard hitting at all. It wasn't until he started to play rock that he had to get fatter sticks and go into the gym and start to train, and it got pretty serious for him.
Yeah.
But, that's something I remember reading from him.
Yeah, and your early influences, because you started early, 6 years old, I think.
That's right.
And mm-hmm. your earlier influences are all jazz guys.
Yeah.
And I know you teach when you can.
Yeah, that's right.
As I do, and last couple of years I became aware that somebody was saying that research was showing that the music that moves us most when we're young, particularly as musicians, is the music that we will gravitate back towards
mm-hmm.
in our later years. So mm-hmm. So as a teacher, are you introducing your students to these great jazz players?
Do you know what? I'm more introducing my students, if possible, to more funk players.
Uh-huh.
Because I think there's a great mixture between the rock and the jazz.
Yeah.
And in that mixture comes out the funk.
Yes.
And
I
think funky music is not to be shy music. You know, it's pretty, not aggressive, but it's pretty full on.
It's real energy.
Yeah, it's a real energy when it gets going. Same as jazz. I mean, jazz is very energetic as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And it can be very loud, you know, Tony Williams or...
Yeah.
Philly Joe Jones, you know, all those guys are hard hitters, Art Blakey.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think it's more or less the passion and the aggression that you put towards, especially playing drums.
Yes.
That comes across. And I think my students are looking at more funky and Latin riffs than jazz riffs, purely because they can get their head around the funk more than the jazz, because jazz is, as you know, very complex. So.
It is, but the funk, getting to grips with the funk first is a great way to get your foot in the door to
absolutely.
The jazz stuff, by
absolutely.
All means. And the Latin, with all the great offbeat stuff and funny time signatures, albeit played over the top of anchored...
That's right, yeah.
Fours and eights.
Well, I mean, I find, to be quite honest, I find Latin very, very, very taxing. Because it is very complex and it does cater for multi rhythms.
Yes.
So,
you
know, although jazz is complex, I think Latin is more complex rhythmically.
And in terms of its four limb independence.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah. So, what was your first kit then, Mel?
My first professional kit. Well, professional, when I was 14, mm-hmm. Was the Slingerland kit.
Oh, okay.
And that was a beautiful kit. I always remember that kit. My very first kit was actually a Trixon kit, which I traded in for the Slingerland.
Yeah.
And that was the first kit I actually owned. It was bought by my mother, mm-hmm. and my recollection was it had Zin cymbals. And
yes.
Everplay heads.
Yes.
But the Everplay heads that I got were the wrong size because Trixon are odd sizes.
Yeah, that's true. You didn't have the asymmetric shells.
No, I didn't have the asymmetric shells, but they're odd sizes. They're 14 by 3/4 snare drum or something
that's
like
right.
that.
So yeah.
It's very strange sizes. So I couldn't get the right or the correct heads all the time for that.
Mm-hmm.
But I traded that in for the Slingerland, which I was very, very, very happy with.
Yeah.
And I used that up until I think I was about 20, because I turned professional when I was 16 and used that kit pretty much to do all the cabaret circuit and everything else. So
yeah,
it was a great kit.
Good old apprenticeship.
Mm.
Yeah. And so you're a man who clearly likes to have a new drum kit once in a while. You've been with a load of brands.
I'm not really proud of being with a load of brands, to be quite honest.
I wasn't knocking it.
Yeah, but I think a lot of people do have the reputation of changing brands a lot. Mm. Myself included, probably Billy Cobham. You know, they change around, and I think people don't realise why that happens. And I think the answer to that is basically it's a business. So if you're endorsing a drum kit and you feel that drum kit is right for you at that particular time, then that's fine. But, you know, if the business acumen breaks down or the business partnership breaks down, then you have to move on. And I'm sure that, you know, that a lot of players have been vindicated by this situation, and quite rightly so, I guess, you know, and you become almost a drum prostitute in this sense. But, you know, it's business, you know. Yes. and business has to go on.
Yeah.
And I think really, you know, I think a lot of people forget as well that I was with, for instance, Pearl for 10 years.
Yes.
Before I moved on, and with Premier for probably 6 years before the company disbanded. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think I was pretty faithful for the right reasons to the company.
Yeah.
But
those changes come about for a lot of different reasons.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Very, sometimes simply a change of personnel in the drum company
exactly.
can trigger it up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that happened. Yeah.
Yeah. As it does in, or as it used to when we had major record labels. Very often whole, you know, artists or bands' whole career trajectory changed because their handler was changed at the record company. So yeah, there's all sorts of reasons why that happens. So who was your best teacher, would you say, in every sense, not literally as a drum teacher?
I would say my father, because my father and my brother, because they both encouraged me to play the drums or to play music. And they spurred me on, although at first my father wanted me to get a real job.
Yes.
But, you know, once he saw that I was enthusiastic and I could really cut it as a full-time musician, then he backed me to the hill. And the same with my brother, you know, because my brother was a musician anyway, so he understood that.
Yeah.
As far as actual tuition, Brian Spring was a big influence on my playing. He still is a phenomenal player, and he had a lot of. He taught me the to be dedicated to your art, and that was the most important thing for me, because many people would take up music and they do it in a half-hearted way.
Yes. Yeah.
But he taught me the realization and the dedication to be a true professional. And that was very important to me at the time,
yeah.
Even though I was young.
Good advice for you to pass on to your students.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. You know, yeah. If you want to do something, do it properly.
Yes. Yeah, totally.
Don't do it half-hearted.
So what would you say is the most profound piece of advice you've ever received from anybody?
Always have a backup plan. Yeah. I think whatever you do, whatever field you tend to get into, and whatever you do in life, always have a plan B and a plan C, because you never know what's going to be around the corner.
Yeah, for sure. So for sure, that's sound advice. Are you listening, people? Take note. Have you got a favourite rock and roll or showbiz anecdote to share with us?
Oh. There's been many, isn't there, over the years?
There must have been. Christ, 32 years with one band. I think
treat everybody as if you'd want to be treated.
Yeah.
I don't piss people off if you can help it.
Yeah.
I think be true, be courteous, be nice. And I think... the world would be nice to you.
Yeah. You get back what you'd send out.
Exactly. Because if you start to be difficult, let's say, and star-like, then it will hit you in the end.
Yeah, we've all met people who are like that.
Exactly. No names being jousted.
No. So how does being a member of such a big act as Simple Minds, how does that work on a day-to-day basis? I mean, do you stay in touch with each other? Do you just come together once in a while?
To be quite honest, I mean, I think, well, within this unit, I don't really have too many pals, as it were. I think we speak as colleagues, but I think, you know, to be deep friends, certainly within this camp, is doesn't really happen. Mm. And I think we have a mutual respect in the camp, let's say.
Yes.
But, you know, I don't think there's any huge friendship in Simple Minds. I think it's a business and we just get on with it.
Yes, yeah.
Obviously, we do speak, but...
Well, it must be hard on the road with people that you've known that length of time, 30-something years, to know what to say to each other after breakfast in the morning.
Well, yeah, I think really it's more about, like I said, just getting on with the job and being courteous, really. I think, certainly for myself, I like to spend a lot of time by myself and to do my own thing.
Yes.
Because if you're with people 24/7, the last thing you want to do is be on top of each other all the time.
Yeah.
So I think space is a great thing. And also... dare I say it, I think sleep is the most important thing on a tour of this size as well.
Absolutely.
Sleep and rest,
yeah,
because
yeah.
A lot of people take that for granted, or they think really every night is a party night.
Yeah.
You know, when you come to a gig, they expect you to be partying with them, or, you know, and it's really not about that. It's about a job.
Yes.
But it's a job in the public profile, and it's a job that I guess people who come to the gigs want to enjoy, which I could understand. But for us, on our side, it's a job.
Yep. You've got to deliver on all respects, haven't you?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think really to the rest time is very, very, very important.
Yeah. And how is this tour logistically handled? Are you kipping on the tour bus, or are you hoteling it? I know different people prefer different ways. Sometimes the logistics have to work in a certain way.
Well, on this tour, it's been great because we haven't been flying, which is my bugbear. Ah. Because I think it's on long haul, obviously you have to fly. But on this tour, being in Europe, we've done probably one or two flights, and the rest has been by bus. Which has been great. So you can get on the bus, have your own space, sleep if you want to sleep, read a book, rest.
Yeah.
But the I think...
Listen to the Global Drum Network podcast.
Yeah, exactly. But you can really relax, I'd say, on the bus rather than flying. Because flying is very stressful, as you know.
Yeah.
And to be jumping on and off... a lot of aircraft is stressful enough.
Yeah.
So on this tour, no, we had buses.
Yeah.
And it's been very good.
Working well.
Yeah.
So is there anywhere in the world that you haven't been to?
The answer to that is no.
Fantastic.
I think I've been to most places, either it be holiday.
Yes.
Or, you know, visiting or for work.
Yeah.
But we've been to most places.
And do you actually get a chance to take a look at the places that you're in?
Yeah, we do. We get to visit most places with at least one or two days either side of us performing. So,
well, that's great.
It's not really a problem to get a feel of the countries that we visit.
Yeah, and the culture.
And the culture.
I always think that's really sad when people say... I'm a big motorsport fan, and they say you spend too much time in airports and just going straight to where you've got to be, and you never get to absorb any of the culture. That's a shame, isn't it?
It's pretty similar to the music.
Mm.
Music touring situation. It's like a big circus, basically.
Yes.
And, you know, you get time. You get time to to visit.
So, so on that kind of drift, while we're still on there, then what about those huge stadium gigs like Live Aid and Nelson Mandela Day?
Mm-hmm.
How much of the actual occasion are you able to absorb and take in and participate in, I guess?
Pretty much the whole thing.
Yeah.
I don't think there's, you know, certainly for Live Aid, we were there, we happened to be there recording anyway.
Okay.
For Once Upon a Time.
Yeah.
So I think we went in probably 2 days before and got a feel for what was going on.
Yeah.
And I think we were there one or two days afterwards as well.
Right, because you were over in the States.
Yeah, we were in Philadelphia for that one. And we came from New York to Philadelphia to perform.
Yeah.
And, no, it was electrifying.
Yes.
Electrifying.
I bet it was.
Yeah.
The whole occasion.
Absolutely.
The global jukebox thing, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, it's always great to perform on those sort of big events, as it were. We're just about to go out to Vegas to play the Billboard Music Awards.
Okay.
And it's an honorary spot for the Breakfast Club, which we featured in.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be a big event coming up after the tour.
Nice.
Which should be fun.
Yeah.
So we get to still travel to far-flung places.
Yes.
A lot.
That's great. So what's the funniest thing you've ever seen on tour, Mel?
There's many, many funny events that I've seen. Too many to explain. But I think one of the things that probably stuck in my mind was, probably wasn't funny at the time, but I think falling off stage when it was a slight accident, let's say.
Yes.
And, I fell off stage, and that was pretty strange.
Mid-song?
Pretty much, yeah. It was mid-song, yeah. It was at the start of Waterfront.
Yes.
And my drum tech usually takes the stool away from me.
Yes.
Before. I mean, this is way back in the day.
Right.
And Waterfront was the beginning song, so I used to stand up and get the crowd going. And
ba-dum, ba-dum,
exactly,
ba-dum,
yeah.
Ba-dum,
ba-dum. And I went to sit back down, and the stool wasn't there.
Christ.
So the legs were up in the air, and the keyboard player was in tears at this event. So you could imagine it was...
Bandmates always sympathetic to
exactly,
this.
Always sympathetic to what was going on. But it was quite a laugh, yeah, it was quite funny as well.
Nice.
Well, at the time it wasn't that funny, but when I look back on it, it was very humorous.
Yeah. So my next question was going to be the time travel one. If you had access to a time machine and could travel backwards or forwards in time to any moment, maybe you would go back and fix that, or where else would you go?
That's an interesting question. I've never been asked that question before.
Yeah.
But I think, I don't know if I'd go back, because if I went back, it would never be the same.
Mm.
And what would you change? And would you just experience that part for that time?
Yeah, would you go back to Live Aid?
Or would you like to relive that time forever, if you see what I mean?
Yes, yeah, stay locked in it, in the moment, yeah.
It's strange. I mean, I would love to go back to the time when I played with Robert Palmer.
Yes.
Because that was truly special.
Yes.
And that was a truly magnificent event, musically, spiritually.
Yeah.
So I'd like to go back to that time and relive that, because that was fantastic.
Hmm.
It really was electrifying. Apart from that, I wouldn't like to go back, because I've lived it already, so there'd be no point going back to that to relive it again.
Yes.
And I think the past is the past.
Okay.
And should be kept there.
So maybe you would go forwards in time.
Well, I wouldn't like to go forward, because you'd be that much older, so you'd have to, you know, it'd be a strange one. I think I'd like to have eternal youth.
There you go. That'll work.
So, not to go forward, not to go back, just to stay as I am.
Yeah. Why not? Why not indeed?
That'll be the one.
Yeah, okay. That's grand. So, tell us about your own side project, the Fusion Project.
Well, the Fusion Project was a project that I got together 6-7 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's no longer really functional.
Ah, it's a
shame. Purely because my partner decided to take off for LA, and he's over in LA doing what he does. So there was really no point in continuing with the Fusion Project. The other project, which is probably closer to my heart now, is a project called The Jokers.
Oh, right.
And it's a four-piece rock band, which I actually manage as well. And that's a project which is going to be ongoing from now until whenever it starts to get some notoriety.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pretty how can I say? It's a very theatrical band live.
Sounds
and
good.
And they are excellent players.
Yeah. Original
excellent
stuff?
Performers, yeah. Original stuff.
Okay. And do you sing in that one?
Well, I sing backing vocals, but uh-huh. I don't sing lead.
Uh-huh.
Got a great singer. But they're a great band. Great songs, great live act, great band. So
look out for them.
Look out for them.
Yeah.
The Jokers.
Yeah. They must be patient while you're off on tour doing that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was actually while I was on tour that we kind of got everything together, so it wasn't that much of a...
Yeah, you didn't pull them all together and then start off on tour.
No. It's been together actually for 10 years.
Oh, right, oh, okay.
But I've recently joined them and taken over the arrangement and management.
Right.
And so it's been within the tour that we've been getting things together.
Great. Okay.
Including the new album.
Fantastic. Do you have any pet peeves? Things that really get under your skin?
Ignorance.
Yeah.
Gets under my skin.
Yes.
I think ignorance.
Me too.
And I think really there are quite a lot of ignorant people in this world. And I think really that ignorance comes from selfish behaviour as well.
Yeah.
And also peace as well. I mean, there's not enough peace in this world as well. People keep cranking on about peace ethics, but I think there's not enough peace in this world. I think a lot of people should be more caring.
Yeah.
And there's too much heartache in this world and too many political ideals that really shouldn't be prevalent in this world as well.
They really shouldn't be clashing, should they?
No, they shouldn't be clashing. And you know, and it's a shame that it's like that, you know.
It is, and the ignorance of the other point of view comes into that.
Exactly.
Ignorance and arrogance is often tied in.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
And egotism.
Yes.
Oh, you know, yeah. there's a lot of people with huge egos in this world as well, which should be curbed as well, but... You know,
so often it's the noisy ones that actually have the least to be noisy about.
Pretty much. Yeah. Pretty much. Like my father used to say, I think you just beware of the silent ones.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. That's true. Still waters run deep.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, you've got a gig to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to say thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
I'm going to finish by asking you, Global Drum Network is all about the passion. Whatever you play, play it with passion. So what makes you most passionate about drumming, and who or what inspires you these days?
I think the passion for me is to see young people or young musicians get along and aspire to their art and to be dedicated to their art. You know, it's kind of weird these days when you see youngsters, especially for myself, playing drums, and they're incredible.
Mm.
You know, they've got incredible feel now. Some of them, let's say, wouldn't know the basics. Mm-hmm. They've got a lot of chops and they don't know the basics, but But there's a lot of players out there that know the basics now, and they've studied their art, and they really want to play, and that inspires me.
Yes.
And really the passion that, you know, that music should be live, and it shouldn't be faked, shouldn't be mimed.
Yep.
You know, I'm very, very much the advocate of live music.
Yes, not the karaoke culture.
No, exactly, no. Yeah. And, you know, live music wins for me.
Most definitely. Thank you, Mel.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
For freeing up the time in your busy schedule for this.
Thank you very much.
And I hope you have a stormy one tonight.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And sure enough, they blew the doors off the place. Now, the drum industry has its fair share of custom builders, all with their own unique style and cachet. Some build drums from exotic timbers recovered from extreme surroundings. Others take precious metals and beat the living daylights out of them. If you've ever fancied owning a truly unique one-off drum built from a recycled piece of history, our next guest might just be your man. Here's our chat with Tim Broughton of Provenance Drums. Here we are then once again. Hello, listeners. If you can hear any jet noise in the background of today's piece, there's a very good reason for that. We're actually very close to MOD, Boscombe Down, Britain's most secret aviation test and evaluation centre, for over 70 years. So if there is any jet noise in the background, that would be why. So why are we here, I hear you asking? Well, apart from the fact that we're in my teaching studio, we thought that a place with such engineering history would be the most appropriate spot to meet today's guest, who is Tim Broughton from Provenance Drums.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, Tim. You're very welcome, because there are a number of subjects that I know are close to both of our hearts. And for those of you listeners out there who aren't yet familiar with Provenance and the whole ethos behind the company and the instruments that you make, perhaps you could just give us a bit of background on that.
Okay, well, as you mentioned, Bob, the name of the company is Provenance Drums, which is a French word in actual fact that means of origin or history. And I chose that name because I wanted to initially make a snare drum out of something with a past, historical past, something interesting, namely a Spitfire, from my love of my childhood love of aviation and classic British design sports cars and so on and so forth.
That's great. And what gave you that passion and that interest in iconic British designs and engineering?
Well, I spent a fair amount of my time in my childhood watching old Sunday matinee films that happened to be around at the time on when there was only like two channels on the telly, possibly three.
Yes.
And there was a lot of sort of war films on and classic British movies that all contained interesting historical pieces of aviation and motor cars, you know, old Jaguar police cars and Spitfires and all kind of stuff like that. And, you know, having played the drums for a very long time and love drums, I love drumming like most guys out there who play. I thought the idea of creating a snare drum particularly from something iconic and something with history would be quite an interesting thing to do.
Yes, and every piece is unique?
Yep, every snare that I make is unique. They're all made from historical artifacts. For example, the first one that I made was from the V8 cylinder head from a 1982 Rolls-Royce Silver Shadow, and it's cast at a foundry, machined, and then the lugs and the strainers and so on are put on, and it all went off from there.
Yeah, so that's intriguing. And I guess you've been playing drums a similar length of time to myself when Job was a lad.
Yeah. Yes, I've been playing quite a long time, played in lots of bands and I'm still playing.
Great.
And still, you know, still gigging regularly. I've just got a decent snare drum to play on.
One that's unique to you and no one else has one like it.
That's right, yeah.
Great.
Absolutely.
And did you have a particular sound in mind, or was that choice led by desire to make a drum from a unique metal?
Well, that's a good question. I went for aluminium because aluminium, I think, is a very nice material to make a snare out of. There are cast aluminium snares available. The famous, you know, Ludwig...
Mm-hmm. What's the Acrolite?
The Acrolite is rolled aluminium, mm-hmm. Possibly the most recorded snare in history.
Yes.
And so I definitely went for aluminium for that reason. It's a nice sort of middle ground between wood and metal.
Yes.
And obviously being cast, it sings. If you hold the casting and hit it, it rings like a bell.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that it's aluminium, which is quite interesting.
So you got the idea to make your dream snare drum.
Yeah.
You tracked down a certifiably historical source of metal.
Yep. It had to be a Rolls-Royce. I mean, I just thought, you know, the Merlin on a Spitfire was Rolls-Royce. Rolls-Royce is an iconic brand that is, you know, intrinsically linked with quality.
Yes.
And I just thought, you know, if I'm going to do anything, I've got to start at the top. And I thought, you can't really get any better than a Rolls-Royce. So I started looking out for material, speaking to hobbyists and enthusiasts who own and work on these vehicles. And once I'd kind of got to know them a bit and they kind of realised and understood what I was doing, they welcomed me with open arms and, you know, were very helpful either in actually giving me material or passing on to their mate who happens to live down the road or in the next village who's got an old roll sitting in his front garden. Wow. Or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And there's a great fraternity of those people out there who love what they do, a bit. Yes. Like drummers, and are absolutely passionate about keeping the traditional designs and engineering going and, you know, for the future.
Yes, and being prepared to share, very. Yeah. Much like the drumming community.
That's
is.
Right.
Yeah, and keeping that shared passion moving along. In this particular case, with the material being recycled.
Yep.
Into something new and usable, rather than sitting rusting away in a shed somewhere. And so I was going to ask how it is that you find the materials with that certifiable history, and really you've answered that. So you built your Rolls-Royce snare, your dream unique snare drum. How about telling us about some of the ones which followed on? Did you kind of push a snowball up to the top of the mountain, and that then, when you let it go at the top, all sorts of new ideas?
Yeah, very much so. What I wanted to do was build a snare drum using a historic material, but I had to check out and see what it sounded like once it was made, because, you know, I had this idea that I could make a quality product, but if I was going to seriously look at it as a business, I had to have something that works, that sounded really good. And I built the snare. I showed it to a number of drummers whose opinions I value very highly, who know what they're talking about, and they were completely blown away by the sound of the snare, the whole provenance ethos, if you like.
Yeah.
And in fact, both of them bought one at a later date, which was great for me. And the thing did kind of snowball, and in my search to find interesting and different materials, I came across the wheel of an F-4 Phantom jet fighter, which I thought, well, you know, again, it's aluminium. Fortunately, it wasn't magnesium, otherwise it would have blown up when they tried to cast it. But yes. I had to check that out first. But this is obviously a slightly different aluminium. It's aircraft aluminium. It's flown at twice the speed of sound. So it's got an interest there. And I think the second snare that was cast was the F4 Phantom, which I've used very much as a sample snare, which various people have tried and really, really liked.
Yes.
So after that, I looked at Jaguar, because again, Jaguars, I love Jags, and mm-hmm. and I managed to get hold of a straight six 4.2 1966 cylinder head, which I thought again was cool. Mm. Bentley S2 V8, which Tom Meadows' snare was made out of.
Uh-huh. The guy with the
and
guy
so,
with the neck, yeah.
So there was an emphasis on aluminium, but then I started looking at timbers, and I thought, well, let's see. And I just happened to be around locally, where I managed to get hold of some timber from a Thames barge, because I'm in Maldon, and that's where all the Thames barges are, yes. are based. And there was a bit being cut out because it was rotten, and I found a bit that wasn't, and made a snare from that. And the story goes on. And cruise liners, whiskey barrels. The real piece de la resistance, if you like, was finding a guy locally to me that does up and restores Merlin engines. and he's got two Merlins and three Griffins. And these are V-12 World War II engines.
Yes.
And he had a Merlin that was being broken up to take parts off for another one that he was rebuilding.
Okay, yep.
And to get hold of this stuff is really difficult, and it's very expensive.
There is, of course, a whole industry that's sorry, just in case the listeners aren't aware, the Merlin and the Griffin are aero engines, so yep. These will have been powering the likes of the Spitfires and Hurricanes.
Absolutely.
And
Mosquitoes.
Mosquitoes and yep. Mustangs
yep.
in World War II. And there is quite an industry that's sprung up now to rebuild and restore and in some cases replicate those Second World War warbird aircraft to put them back up in the sky. So I would imagine getting hold of a disused engine block or cylinder head would be really tricky, because there are so many of these specialist restorers all around the world clamouring for these parts.
You're right. You're absolutely right, Bob. And the thing is that they are highly desirable. Even you know, the piston end of a Merlin will sell on eBay for hundreds of pounds. You
wow.
know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this stuff doesn't come up, and when it does, it's very, very expensive. Also, you're right in that there are a lot of enthusiasts who rebuild these engines. Unfortunately, the chances of them ever getting to an aircraft are very unlikely, because they have to pass such strict aviation rules and testing that the chances are they would not come up to spec to go up in an aeroplane.
Yeah.
But having said that, I know that I think somewhere in the West Country there is a company that services and, you know, rebuilds Merlins that are used at Duxford and various other places for flying aircraft.
Yes.
But this guy puts them on the back of a trailer and takes them to air shows, and just people just stand there and he sets it off, and it's just amazing, the sound and everything, you know. So that's what this guy does. And
yeah.
I managed to get hold of this this crankcase off him, with which I built a 14x6.5 cast snare from the crankcase of this Merlin. And it was, for me, it was like I'd kind of achieved the goal that I wanted to achieve. But on top of that, Cherise Osi, who is a friend and a great drummer, who's just, I think, finished playing with Brian Ferry and with Paloma Faith, and has a great CV of people, bought it, and she absolutely loves it. So that was really the icing on the cake for me.
Yeah. And that's actually something I was going to come on to next, Tim. A glance at your website, provenancedrums.com.
Yep.
There's a page on there, Friends with Provenance, which is a nice title, I think. Glowing testimonials from a bunch of really well-known top-draw players. And I think it speaks volumes that these are people who are already signed up for big-name endorsement deals with other manufacturers. I know what a minefield it can be with artists and endorsement deals and all of that, not being seen to be playing brands that they're not contracted to and all of that. But here, these are people who are at the top of their tree, who have seen in provenance unique instruments with a real history and a provenance, who are prepared to put their hands in their pockets just to own such an instrument. And like I say, those are heavy-hitting names. So in addition to Cherise, who of course was on episode 2 of the Global Drum Network, listeners.
Yep.
She's a friend of the show. Who else have you got on the go?
Well, on the Friends page, I've got Todd Sukerman, of course, who was headlined the London Drum Show 2014.
Yes.
And he's heavily endorsed and tied up with Pearl.
Right.
But I think he's known for he's got 75 snares now, his snare collection, over there in Austin, Texas.
Uh-huh.
And he is very much got into the whole provenance thing and contacted me via email. And we were conversing over the internet for quite a long time. After a few months, he decided that he wanted to buy one and he wanted me to make him one. And he said, it's got to be a Rolls Royce, which I guess is understandable.
Mm-hmm.
And his specification was a 14x6, and it was from a 73 Rolls mm-hmm. V8. Silver Cloud, I think. It was nice. Either a Silver Cloud or a Silver Shadow. And
classy.
Eight tube lug, Remo heads, Dunnett strainer. And he loves it. He picked it up at the drum show, came on the stand. We met for the first time. It was a real buzz because he's a great player. And I went and watched his clinic in the theatre that afternoon. But the funny thing was, in January, he emailed me and he said, OK, look, Tim, you've got he's had his eye on this West Pier snare, which is a Purple yes. Heart wooden stay-built snare that was built from the decking of the West Pier in Brighton.
Mm-hmm.
And as a kid, he came over to England as a student and was well into Quadrophenia and yes, actually got took course. A train to Brighton with his mate, and they walked along the beach and soaked up all the vibes of the mods and rockers and stuff. Mm. And he just said to me, Tim, I've got to have that snare. And he bought another one, which is fantastic. Again, putting it in his collection, he's used it, and I'm very proud that he's got a couple.
Yeah, that's great.
A big hero of mine, Barrymore Barlow from Jethro Tull,
yes.
is on the site. Jeff Dugmore, who's obviously, again, appeared on the Global Drum Network.
He has.
Tom Meadows, who went on tour with Kylie in 2011 with a 13x9 car snare that was quite heavy from a 62 Bentley uh-huh. S2, which I think I mentioned earlier. And again, the first reaction was, I think, when I remember when he took it to the soundstage to play,
mm-hmm.
the sound guys were all around it and thought, what snare are you playing? This is phenomenal.
What does that sound like?
Well, it sounds like it sounds, you know.
Yeah.
But the cast, being cast, you've got a lot of ring there. With the 13x9, you've got a lot of depth.
Yes.
And I've heard it. He played it at Abbey Road when Kylie did the Abbey Road sessions, mm-hmm. and he had it really tight for a number, and it sounded really crisp and really sharp, quite kind of military, if you like.
Uh-huh.
But I think for the Aphrodite tour, I think it was tuned slightly lower, but you know.
But that's as his main snare.
Yeah,
yeah.
As his main snare. Well, it was his main snare for the tour. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Proud moment, another proud moment for me.
Yeah.
Evelyn Glennie tried one. The Dame Evelyn Glennie.
Uh-huh.
The world-famous percussionist,
yeah.
tried the Jura snare and really liked it and gave me an endorsement for the website. So again, I've been really, really blessed with some very nice people saying some very nice things about my snares.
And some people who know what they're talking about. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you touched on how the metal shell drums are cast.
Yep.
And the wooden shell snares, amongst which you've brought some today, I'm delighted to say. You have the Ark Royal snare there.
Yep.
And the Jura snare. They're both stave construction.
They are, yeah.
A method which has, you know, on paper, loads of advantages. And I don't know why more manufacturers don't build their drums that way.
Well probably because it's expensive.
Yep.
That's probably the main reason, and time-consuming. But yes, they are renowned for their tone.
Yes, purity drums, of tone.
Purity
yeah.
of tone.
Yeah.
Response. They use a fraction of the glue that, yeah. that a ply shell would use. With the vertical grain, they say it transfers the energy much more quickly in the shell. Yeah, the Ark Royal was, again, you know, I got a lovely review from Adam Jones in Rhythm Magazine mm-hmm. in April this year. And 14x6 stave built. Lovely drum. And its sister...
It's a lovely drum. I'm looking at it as you say that.
Its sister, the 14x7, has just been bought by Emily Dolan Davis.
Really?
So I'm very happy that she is now also playing...
Probably drummers. Taking that out on tour with the Darkness.
Well, who knows?
It'd be a suitably big fat snare for that gig, wouldn't it? Yeah, the Ark Royal drums then. So that's, off the top of my head, Philippine mahogany?
It is. It's Luan. It's a Luan, which is a Philippine mahogany, yeah.
And from the decking?
From the decking of the Ark Royal, the R07, which was built in 1981, and I think decommissioned a couple of years ago, two or three years ago now.
That's a proper slab of history right there.
Yeah. Well, it's circumnavigated the world a few times, you yeah. know. yeah. So it's interesting.
And looking across the room now, the drums are beautiful to look at. They are impeccably built.
Thank you.
And the finishes, certainly all the ones that I've seen, you tend to leave them in their natural state from a visual point of view. Clearly, there are processes involved to preserve the timbers in the case of the timbers and so on.
Yeah.
But you've done nothing to, let's say, colour the natural state of the wood. So both of the wood shell snares that I can see have a natural
well, they're lacquered.
Sheen as opposed yeah. to a high gloss finish,
that's
for
right.
example, and literally no colour tinting is going on. So are there Finnish options?
Well, Provenance is a bespoke snare business. So the idea is that as well as, you know, me making snares from materials that I've, you know, procured over a period of time, I've had inquiries from America. Some guy wanted a snare making out of a Triumph motorcycle because he was well into bikes. If, you know, as quoted in an old Rhythm magazine review, you know, if someone's got an old Ford Anglia in their garage and wants a snare making out of it, then, you know, if I can do it, I'll do it. I mean, this is the beauty of it.
Yes.
Because they are unique, they're all one-offs. Coming back to the finishes, the Arc Royal was French, is just simply French polished. I think there's four coats of French polish on the Arc Royal. The Jura, I think that is French polished as well. I think they're both French polished. And I do, you know, I'm very much into a vintage natural look.
Yes.
Which is why I use tube lugs, because I think they don't go wrong. I like tube lugs. If somebody wants something different, I'm more than happy to get hold of the fittings and put them on. It's down to personal preference. Ian Cape, who is an orchestral percussionist, currently doing Les Miserables in the West End, had a snare built, and he wanted Tama Omnitune lugs.
Oh, okay.
Because he's got a Tama Omnitune kit, and he's used to using those lugs. They're the ones that you can tune from the top, both the bottom and the top head.
Ah, yes,
using a different key.
Right.
And he's used to using those, so I got Omnitune lugs and he had them put on his snare. But for the ones that I make myself, I generally tend to go for tube lugs because I like them.
Timeless, aren't they?
They are, absolutely timeless.
If a drum particularly had a very dark wood and really cried out for brass hoops and lugs, that wouldn't represent a problem.
No, it's not a problem at all.
So standard kit on a Provenance drum from the point of view of hardware, your classic tube lugs, triple flange pressed steel hoops.
Yep.
And a choice of Dunnett or Trick strainers.
Yeah.
But presumably anything goes. It's a bespoke drum, so you've got other options available.
That's right.
Should people choose?
That's absolutely right. And I tend to use Pure Sound snares.
Yes.
And the custom snare, because I think it's a 16 strand rather than a 20. Mm-hmm. I just think you get, you know, you, it's all down to personal preferences. But when I met Gavin Harrison, and he told me that he actually uses, I think, four strands of a snare on his snares.
Interesting.
Don't quote me on that, but I think it was certainly, he used to cut his pure sound snares down because he used to get so much rattle and buzz.
Yes, I've heard that before about, not necessarily about Gavin, but certainly
and
others.
And so I just think that, you know, the 16-strand custom is fine, which is what I tend to put on the snares. On the piccolo over there, the VW piccolo, it's a Gibraltar piccolo snare, which again works very well on that size drum.
Mm-hmm.
But as you say, the die-cast hoops is always a possibility, whatever.
Yeah, anything goes.
Anything goes. And if, you know, I could get them, you know, they can be brass, they can be... I can even get hardware powder-coated now. So
okay.
If people want something a little bit, you know, out there or modern, whatever,
yes,
they can have anything they like. The people that have bought the snares generally go for the sort of vintage, more traditional look.
Yes, excellent. Okay, so as far as Provenance is concerned then, Tim, onwards and upwards, it's all gathering pace like a steam train. What's next? Whole kits?
Well, you're not the first person to mention that, Bob, but you know, part of the problem that I've got is that the materials that I use are in very short supply.
Indeed.
And they are difficult to get hold of. They're also very expensive. A kit, you know, would be phenomenally expensive to make. I don't suppose I could cast a drum kit. It would be far too heavy. A timber kit would be possible. But again, it's a question of having enough material to do that.
Yes, very tricky.
And that's the main reason why I've kind of stuck with snares, really, because snares are the focal point of the kit. And people, you know, they love their snare drum. You know, they'll go a long way to get a snare that they like and they'll stick with it, you know. And the snare drum was the initial concept was all about making a snare. Because most drummers are happy to use any kit, but the snare drum is their thing.
It's very much their signature sound.
Their signature, exactly.
More than the rest of the kit combined, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a point which I think I've read somewhere that you've made in the past is that the company Provenance has built its reputation, rightly so, on the fact that you're breathing new life into a material which has a history of its own, but it's important to stress that the sound that these instruments make is equally as important as its provenance.
Of course.
You know, sometimes that gets overlooked when people look at not necessarily in terms of musical instruments, but certainly in terms of you know, I've seen vintage guitars and other instruments being critiqued on the basis that actually they've gone for the vintage vibe and energy way above the sound that it makes, and so they're looking at a case of form over function. But you're determined that that should not be the case with your drums.
Absolutely. You know, I'm a drummer. I'm not a businessman. I'm a drummer, and that was what got me interested in the whole Provenance thing in the first place. It was my passion for drumming and for playing. And the drums have to sound good. The priority with the first snare that I made was, what is it going to sound like? You know, the fact that if it sounds awful, for want of a better word, and looks great, what's the point in it? I know that a lot of stuff, a lot of live gigs, people play samples and triggers and all the kind of stuff on their kits, and they're not really hearing the kit that you're hearing out front a lot of the time. But,
yes.
You know, in a recording situation or whatever, if the drummer knows what he's doing, he can get a really good sound out of his kit. And I was very fortunate in that the sound quality was as good, if not better, than the provenance of the material, because it couldn't possibly be the other way around.
Yes. Is it? Yes. There wouldn't be any point with that.
No.
Otherwise, you'd just hang it on the wall as an objet d'art,
a piece of
something beautiful to look at.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. No, it has to work. It has to function. It's to be played. That's the absolute priority.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing.
That's all right.
And as always, you'll find links to all our guests' websites on our own site, globaldrumnetwork.com. That's almost it for episode 10. My thanks, as always, to you for taking the time to listen. We hope you enjoyed it. Next time, our special guests will be session master Ash Sohn and teacher to the stars, Bob Armstrong. If you feel you'd like to support our work, do please check out our Patreon page via the video link. And finally, I'd like to take a moment to dedicate this episode to Sophie Jane Spry, who passed away last month, aged 25, after a long illness. We love you, Sophie. Miss you like mad. Drum Network, beating out the rhythm of life worldwide.